Well, good evening again. It's good to see you. We had our business meeting to start off just 15 minutes ago, so we had a word of prayer at that time, and for those of you who joined us or just now joining us, we welcome you online as well. Tonight, of course, looking at the 12 minor prophets, and we're looking at prophet number 8 of the 12, and that is the prophet Habakkuk, and I think that you'll find tonight's study to be interesting. It's a fascinating little book, and God used them in a powerful way. As we look at the 12 minor prophets, we have been looking at a portrait, a portrait of God each one gives us, a little bit of different perspective of God and His dealings with His people. And so we begin every Wednesday night with a minor prophet with a painting or a portrait that kind of symbolizes that prophet. So tonight we're looking at a painting, actually a drawing, you'll see it on the screen here, by the greatest religion painter of the 20th century, a Frenchman by the name of Georges Royal. I'm not real good on my French. Royal. A painting that is depicting his homeland of France during World War I. He painted this between 1922 and 1927. Didn't actually publish it for 1948. But if you might remember, World War I, and we'll keep the painting a picture up there for a moment. If you remember from history, World War I, the Western Front of Europe was absolutely devastated. It took the brunt of World War I. So parts of France and Belgium never recovered. Even to this day, there are portions that never recovered from World War I. Ravaged earth, devastated orchards, burned factories, villages were destroyed. Nothing but phantom cities were left, gaping holes in walls. In fact, one historian said, a waste that was so utter, even the ruin was ruined. And so this is a painting by the Frenchman, and it's entitled, My Sweet Homeland, What Has Become of You? So he's painting the French countryside after World War I. So that also could be the title for Habakkuk tonight. Because he is asking, what has become of my homeland, Judah, God's people? God, what are you doing? Why are you judging the way you're judging? And so as the book of Habakkuk opens, the homeland of Israel is ravaged by the Babylonians. But this raises some theological questions from the prophet Habakkuk, and that's what the book is about. So he's wondering, what has become of my homeland? So let's look at Habakkuk tonight. I hope that you've opened your Bible there. This book is interesting and kind of unique to the other minor prophets because this book is a dialogue between God and Habakkuk, the prophet. Most of the other prophecies are God gives the prophet a message to tell the people. That's not the case here. It's not a message for the people. It's a message between God and Habakkuk. They're having a dialogue in the entire book. Is a dialogue of theological questions. And Habakkuk has some hard questions for God, and primarily two. Number one, why do good things happen to bad people? Similar to Job. And second of all, why do you use a nation worse than we are to judge us? And so we'll talk about that, but those are the two questions that he really was wondering. And then went along with that, he asked the questions, God, why aren't you doing something? Why aren't you active? God, why haven't you, you gave this land to Israel. You remember, you gave it to us. We inhabited it. Why would you take it back? And why are you using nations that are so wicked to punish us, and why do good things happen to them when they're as wicked as the day is long? And so those are the questions he asked. But you know, those are some of the questions we wonder as well, don't we? Sometimes we voice them, sometimes we don't. But sometimes we wonder, Lord, why do such bad people have good things happen to them? Why do people never come to church? Man, their bills are paid, and they got great jobs, and the family's doing great, and why is that, Lord? And here I am, I'm faithful to you, and I'm coming to church, and I have a diagnosis that's not good, and I have someone pass away close to me, and just bad things happen. Why do they get off? And I'm trying to do what's right. And sometimes we wonder those same things. So Habakkuk is an interesting book that really does kind of relate to us today. And I want you to see what God says, what Habakkuk says, and most of all, I want you to see how it ends. It ends powerfully. So first of all, let's look at letter A on your outline, about Habakkuk himself. The book of Habakkuk pictures, first and foremost, a frustrated prophet. A lot like Jonah. You remember Jonah got really frustrated with God because he doesn't want this evil nation to be saved. And so Habakkuk's different, though. He channeled his frustration into prayers and ultimately into praise, whereas Jonah translated his frustration into running away from the Lord. Now, we don't know much about Habakkuk himself. He's only mentioned twice in this book. And all we know about him is basically what he tells us in this small little book. Both of the times his name is mentioned, he identifies himself as Habakkuk the prophet. Now that's unusual because rarely does an Old Testament prophet do that. Can you think of very many other times whenever a prophet says, I'm a prophet? Now you say, oh, wait a minute, what about Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and what? Hold on, and Amos, what about, wait a minute, they said God said they're a prophet. This is really only a few times where a prophet says, I'm Habakkuk the prophet. And so that's led some Bible scholars to kind of theorize on who he was. This could mean the fact that he refers to himself as the prophet in chapter 1, verse 1, and chapter 3, verse 1. It could mean that he was a professional prophet. Now, what does that mean? They had professional prophets in those days, those that had been to seminary. They had what's called a school of the prophets after the days of Samuel, 1 Samuel 19 and 2 Kings 4. And so it could have been he was formally trained. It could have meant that he was a professional prophet rather than the one that God just called out of the sycamore tree or off the farm or something like that, like you do with the others. It also could have been that he was a priest involved in the worship of God in the temple, because the book ends by saying, for the choir director. This book is for the choir director on stringed instruments. So he could have been a priest who actually led worship for the people. So we don't really know. Those are just kind of some of the theories about what he means by Habakkuk the prophet. But we don't really know much about him other than that. Here's letter B, the setting on your outline. The setting, let's look at what was going on. Up to this point, now you remember, we're at book number 8 of the 12. And the first 7 prophets we've looked at every week, you might remember me talking about the Assyrians. How wicked they were, how cruel they were. And these books are in chronological order. So, the first 7 books, the Assyrians have been in the foreground. They are, remember, they were ruthless, they were cruel, they were oppressors, they were terrorists, they were the drug cartels, they used intimidation and fear to keep people under their thumbs. They were in the background for the first 7, but now we're to number 8. And now, as we approach Habakkuk, there has been kind of a change. Now they're about to be defeated. Who defeated them? Well, it took a coalition of 3 groups, basically. The Babylonians, one. They went together with the Medes and the Scythians in a battle. It's called the Battle of Carchemish. That's known throughout history, where the Assyrians were defeated and the Babylonians now take over. So the Babylonians are the greatest world power. So if you remember, the Assyrians conquered the northern part of Israel. Israel's divided up and similar to a civil war, north and south. Northern part was destroyed by Assyria, but the southern part remained. It was not conquered. So the southern part, known as Judah, they thought they were exempt from God's judgment. I mean, think about it. You're in Judah. And you're thinking, wait a minute, the nation came in, another nation, the Assyrians invaded the north, they got to our borders and they stopped and went back home. and they left us, and here we are 150 years later, nothing's happened. What would be your assumption? God's not going to do it to us. Now, we're as sinful as they were, but God's not going to do it to us. We get off scot-free. So Judah was thinking secretly, they're kings and everybody, God will not judge the South. What is it about the South, do you think, as to why they thought he spared them? Anybody know? Jerusalem's there. The Jerusalem, absolutely. The temple's there. Jerusalem's there. God will not touch the South because we got his holy city and his holy temple, and he will not allow anybody to destroy that. That's what they thought. So they thought, we get to sin as much as we want because we live in the South. So prophets came along and said, King Jehoiakim was terrible at this time, and so Habakkuk and other prophets now come along and say, South, if you don't change your ways, you're going to get it just like the North got it. And Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, and that temple's going to be burned. That's exactly what happened, by the way. So they continued their sinning and oppression and injustice and immoral lifestyles and idolatry. So he knows they're going to get it. He just has a problem with why God's waiting so long and why is God using other nations so wicked to do it. Now, Babylon, you say, were they as bad as the Assyrians? Pretty much. Babylon, some say even worse. It's hard to imagine Assyria being worse than Assyria. But Babylon also, they were violent, they were corrupt, they deified their military power, they treated humans like animals, they gathered up fish like in a net, we're told here tonight. They devour nations, people groups, they build their empire, so they were just as bad as the Assyrians. So thus the question by Habakkuk, you got these two evil empires, Lord, why would you use them to judge your people? How can such a holy, good, and just God possibly use corrupt instruments as the Assyrians and the Babylonians? And so he kind of demands an answer from the Lord and an explanation, sets himself on the city wall. I'm going to sit here until I watch and see what you do as my answer. And so that's kind of where the book begins. So let's look now at his message, letter C on your outline. Look in general kind of what it's about. Then we'll actually read it together and kind of stop along the way and see what Habakkuk and God says. Letter C on your outline, his message. Habakkuk gets that God is punishing Judah for the sins. He's fine with that. We're idolatrous. We're unjust. But he has a problem with how God's doing it, as I think we would as well. So here's a summary of the book. Habakkuk begins with crying out to God for an answer. Why are we going to have to suffer the hands of such ruthless people? Chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. And then, verses 5 through 11, God responds by saying, you wouldn't even understand it if I told you. And then Habakkuk responds by saying, okay, you're God, I get that. But can you give me a glimpse? And so God responded with more information and tells the earth to be silent because I'm about to act. And then he talks about that, gives the woes upon Babylon's going to get theirs. Don't worry, they don't get off scot-free. And he talks about that. And then the book closes in chapter 3 with Habakkuk writing a prayer expressing faith in God and but despite the trials and how he's going to trust God no matter how things look. So that's kind of a summary of the book. Now, a couple of other notes before we actually look at the book itself. Habakkuk is interesting because the Apostle Paul in the New Testament quoted it twice. He quoted Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4 on two separate occasions. Romans 1, 17. In Galatians 3:11. So what Habakkuk said struck a chord with the Apostle Paul, who knew the law very well and knew the Old Testament very well. And so Paul used that to reiterate the doctrine of justification by faith in Jesus alone for salvation. So he used that, Habakkuk's quote, to reiterate that we are saved by faith alone, because Habakkuk said, the just shall live by faith, or the righteous will live by faith. Go one step further, Martin Luther, the German reformer, the Protestant Reformation, was saved, converted, by reading Romans 1:17. This is actually the preface to Romans that referenced 1:17, which referenced Habakkuk. So indirectly, Habakkuk influenced the Apostle Paul and Martin Luther. So his words and his thoughts, as God inspired him to write, influenced people, generations who influenced others as well. So as a practical application, I guess you might say, of the book, and then we'll actually read the book itself, I guess some things for us to think through as we read it. One is, God may remain silent and seemingly uninvolved in world events for now. Sometimes you may wonder, look, God, why don't you let the world continue like it is? I mean, we're following as a nation farther away from you. Look at what's going on around the world. Look at the injustice. Look at the number of Christians that are being killed for their faith. They're being martyred. God, why don't you do something about it? And probably all of us at one time or another have looked at the world and said, God, why don't you do something? Why don't you act? And he hasn't. And so Habakkuk asks kind of the same questions. And so what we learn from this is God may remain silent for a while. You would like for him to speak to you now. But he may remain silent for a while. For now. But there will come a day he will move and he will speak. I think another thing to remember here is asking the question, is it okay to question God? Now, I know I was raised in church, and the answer to that question I always heard growing up in church was, no, never question God. But what I find interesting in Job and Habakkuk both is that God never condemned the questions. He never said, you evil outfits, you never question me. He doesn't do that. Their questions are fine. And so Habakkuk asks some hard questions. Now he comes to the conclusion of faith, but he asks some hard questions. And so the question we ask is it okay to question God and what he's doing with respect to reverence? Can we do that? I think another thing we have to look at and come to the conclusion is God is sovereign. God is omnipotent, which means all powerful, and God has all things under his control, even when we don't see his dominion. God has everything under control. Your life, every aspect of your life, he's sovereign. Now, there are times you're going, God, why aren't you doing something? Why aren't you acting? But you have to look at this book and say, God is sovereign. And he's got things under control, whether it looks like it or whether you think he does or not. He will work. He'll punish the wicked. Nobody gets by with anything. But yes, we sometimes wonder why good things happen to bad people and why God uses the wicked to judge the righteous. And we do wonder that as well. So, having said that, let's look at the book and then we'll wrap up. Chapter 1, verse 1. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. The word oracle there means to lift up. Some people would translate it revelation. But it's basically speaking out. So it's something Habakkuk saw from the Lord and it's speaking out about it. Verse 2. Habakkuk's complaint, verses 2 through 4. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you'll not hear? Or cry to you, violence, and you won't save. So in other words, why aren't you acting and doing anything? The word's interesting there, the word for violence means ethical and physical both. So you see these nations around you that not only are doing physical things to people, they're ethically immoral what they're doing to people. Why, God, I cry out that what's happening and you're not even listening. Verse 3. Why do you make me see iniquity And why do you idly look at wrong? In other words, God, if you really exist, why don't you do anything when wrong happens? Destruction, violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. Verse 4, so the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. In other words, it is unjust of you, God, to sit there. The law is doing nothing. It's paralyzed. Nothing's happening. People just get by with wickedness. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes perverted. So that's his first complaint. Violence, no justice. God's not doing anything. Verse 5, the Lord answers. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded. By the way, just as a quick note, and I won't do this all the way through, but just from time to time, it's interesting what he says. The word astounded there is a double imperative, which you don't see very many times. A double imperative means it actually adds to the emphatic emphasis of an imperative. So the word astounded literally just means you just drop your jaws. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and drop your jaws. I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Who are the Chaldeans? Babylonians. I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. So God's admitting they're bad people. Verse 7, they're dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Verse 8, their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like the eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence, all their faces forward. So if you picture an army, face forward, steadfast, angry, intent on coming to capture you and do evil things to you, that was the Babylonians. Verse 10, at kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. Nobody is stopping them. They laugh at every fortress. They pile up earth. And they take it. Verse 11. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on. So as easy as the wind blows through, that's how easy they're going to march through and take your land. Guilty men whose own might is their God. They don't worship anybody but their muscles. And they're powerful and they're strong and they're going to capture you. So Habakkuk goes, okay, I'm more confused now than ever. God, I ask you a question. Why? And all you tell me is about how bad they are. I know that. I know how bad they are. So, verse 12 is his second complaint. Habakkuk says, I'm confused. Are you not from everlasting? O Lord my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment. And you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? So he's going, wait a minute, God, well, hold on a second. I ask you why you use such ruthless, wicked people to come in and judge us, and then you just tell me how bad and evil and wicked they are. You're looking at them. And you're doing nothing. And they're coming after what you call the apple of your eye in Psalms. So, what gives? Verse 14. You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings them all up with a hook and drags them out with a net and gathers them in a dragnet, so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. And for by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever. So what Habakkuk did was he gave the analogy of these Babylonians marching through the land and capturing nations and kings and peoples like fishermen catching fish in a net. And so he uses this analogy, just throw the net out there and catch more fish, and throw the net out there and capture another nation and capture more people. Why on earth are you just letting them march through like a fisherman catching fish? Are humans not more important than fish? I'm confused. I don't know what you're doing, Lord. So we go to chapter 2. So he says, Habakkuk says, I will take my stand at my watchpost, station myself on the tower, and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So he says, okay, Lord, that's my complaint. I'm going to go up on the watchtower. I'm going to sit and wait, see if an army comes in. I'm going to see just what you do about this, because it doesn't look like you're doing a whole lot. So we go to chapter 2, verse 2, and God answers, and he answers for a long time. And he basically says this: yes, I'm going to use Babylon to judge Israel. But number 2, God is not mocked. Nobody gets by with things. May look like it, but they don't. Babylon's going to get theirs. And by the way, they did. The Persians captured them. They're going to get theirs. And here's what's going to happen. So here's what God says. He answers back to Habakkuk, chapter 2, verse 2. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. So he says, okay, you're up there on the watchtower, get you a notebook, get you a pen, and you write down what you see. Verse 3, for still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. In other words, it's delayed, but it's coming. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. So, Habakkuk, there is a distinction between the righteous who is sinful, like Judah was, who can repent, and a godless nation who's coming in as judge. But the righteous, the just, will truly live by faith. Verse 5. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, the grave, like death. He never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. What God is saying is Babylon is like a wine, like a drunkard wanting more rights, addicted to wine. They are addicted to killing. It's like an arrogant man never at rest. It's like death can't get enough of the grave can't get enough of death. People keep dying. They keep gathering people, collecting people as their own. That's what the Babylonians are doing. But as a result, they will be judged. So starting in verse 6 of chapter 2, God now gives 5 woes, W-O-E. Woe meaning, listen, here comes judgment. Woe to you. So he begins the first of 5 different woes. First woe is verses 6 through 8, chapter 2, and it's the woe for being haughty and aggressive. Remember, he's talking about Babylon. Verse 6, shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him to say, for him, and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. That's what Babylon did. For how long? And loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoiled for them, because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the people shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. First woe is, you are such a haughty, arrogant people, and you've been aggressive toward others. That's the first reason you're going to get it. Number two, the second woe, verses 9, 10, and 11. That is the woe for being cheaters. You exploited people and you extorted people. Verse 9, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high like he can't be touched, to be safe from the reach of harm, thinks he's untouchable. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples, and you have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork will respond. So in other words, you're a cheater. You've cheated people, extorted, you've exploited them. And because of that, that's a second reason, second woe, you're going to get yours. Third woe, number three, verses 12, 13, to 14. A woe for being cruel, violent. And they were. Verse 12. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So here's the third woe against the Babylonians. You're cruel, you're violent, you're going to get yours. But there will come a day for my people when the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God like waters cover the waters cover the sea. So what he's saying is still coming a day God's people will rule. You're cruel and violent, you're going to get yours. That's the third woe. Here's the fourth one. Verses 18, or 15 through 17. Fourth woe is because you are perverse, you're inhumane. Verse 15. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. So you get people drunk so they'll strip naked so you can gaze at them. How perverse is that? Just gave that as an example of what they did. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. Verse 17, the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to the cities, and all who dwell in them. Fourth reason, Babylon, you're getting yours. You are a perverted, inhumane group of people. Number five, the last woe, verses 18 to 20. Because you are an idolater, you're trusting a piece of wood to be your god. Verse 18. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. For its maker trusts in its own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So again, you see the juxtaposition of Babylon, you're going to get yours, you're wicked, but God will reign supreme. So five woes, five reasons Babylon will be judged. So that ends God's speaking. Chapter 3 is Habakkuk's response. And to his credit, he doesn't keep asking questions or keep questioning or wondering more things from the Lord. He closes with a prayer of praise. God, I trust you. So he begins a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigoano, which was a psalmic prayer. It was plural, and the plural, it literally means to go astray, or it could mean to reel, like you go back and forth. And so some Bible scholars, so that was the rhythm, and possibly again why he was a temple worship leader. It's the rhythm as it was sung. And so the prayer was meant to be possibly sung in church by His people. Verse 2. O Lord, I have heard the report of You and Your work, O Lord, do I fear. The word report there means somebody might have brought him news from another land. It's possible. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. And then starting in verse 3, Habakkuk starts to reminisce of when God actually delivered His people. He goes all the way back to the Exodus. And so you're going to start seeing references to the Red Sea in the Exodus, verse 3. God came from Teman, that's Edom. And the Holy One from Mount Paran, that's toward the Sinai, toward the Negev area. His splendor covered the heavens. The earth was full of His praise. His brightness was like the light, rays flashed from His hand, and there He veiled His power. Before Him went pestilence. Plague followed at His heels. So He's starting to describe God's people in bondage and God delivering them out. And how powerful He was to do it. Verse 6. He stood and measured the earth. He looked, shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. Cushan were the nomads of Edom. And the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. That's where they were coming out from the Red Sea. Verse 8, was Your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was Your anger against the rivers? Or Your indignation against the sea? When You rode on horses on Your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from Your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. In other words, You made everything right and You will again. Verse 10, the mountains saw You and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. So even the elements saw how great God was and how He acted on behalf of His people. Verse 11. The sun and the moon stood in their place at the light of Your arrows as they sped. Possibly a storm. Maybe describing a storm where God showed His power. At the flash of Your glittering spear. Verse 12. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of Your people, for the salvation of Your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with His own arrow the heads of the warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with Your horses. The surging of mighty waters, probably describing the Red Sea where the Egyptians were drowned. Verse 16, I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters my bones. In other words, no strength left in my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. So what he's saying was, God, I hear Your answer, what You're going to do to the Babylonians, and my mind goes back to hearing about our history as God's people. We were in bondage in Egypt. You brought us out. The Egyptians we thought were so powerful. You destroyed them. You delivered Your people. And God, if You did it once, I know You'll do it again. So I'll trust You. Doesn't look good, but I'll trust You. And so here Isaiah closes verse 17. Confidence in God. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flocks be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. Stop there for a moment. What a prayer of confidence that is. God, if my fig trees don't bud, if my fruit doesn't make, if my olives fail, if I don't have any food, if my flocks are cut off, no herd in the stalls, if I lose everything, I'm going to trust in you. And I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. Folks, if you can pray Habakkuk's prayer honestly, that is strong faith in God. Because a lot of times we're like, Lord, I know you're going to take care of me, but would you do this and do that? But whenever you come to the point of God, it's okay if my flocks don't, if the flocks are gone and the fruit's not there. It's okay. Because I'll still rejoice and glory in the God of my salvation. Verse 19, God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's and makes me tread on the high places, the hinds, the deer. They were known for being fast and having sure feet. God, I may walk on some rocky times, but you're my strength and you're my sure footing. And that's how it closes. To the choir master with stringed instruments. So maybe he was a temple worship leader. So questions? Yeah. God, why? 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 But he closes with one of the strongest prayers of confidence in God, even though we hadn't seen the answer yet. What a great lesson for us. Lord, we can ask why. But come to the conclusion, I don't walk by sight. I walk by faith. And the just will live by faith. Father, thank you tonight for this powerful book. And Lord, may each one of us here tonight come to the final concluding prayer of Habakkuk. Father, even though there be no fig trees blossoming or fruit on the vines, Lord, if the produce of the olive fails and the fields yield no fruit, and no herd in the stalls, God, I just pray that we as your people will joy in the God of our salvation, and you will be our strength. Lord, tonight we don't live by answers. We live by faith. And I just pray that those areas of our lives tonight, God, that maybe we're wanting answers in, maybe, Father, you just bring us to the point of we're going to trust you by faith. So, Lord, thank you for this passage tonight, for the book of Habakkuk, and may it resonate with us, be a part of our lives as we continue to go forward to be your people. Thank you for this church. Help us to trust you in the same. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless you. We'll see you on Sunday.